Hi, this is Melissa Wood Tepperberg, and this is the Move with Heart podcast.
Are you ready?
Just breathe it all in.
I want to talk.
I can't lie.
I was like, it's going to be short, sweet, and very spicy.
And we're going to get right into it because apparently some of you think I talk too much.
Where do I even begin? With sitting down with Molly Bloom. Finally, I've been wanting to have this time with her for so long because her story is riveting. It honestly, if you have watched Molly's Game or read the book Molly's Game, you know she just keeps you on the edge of her seat. But what she does after being knocked down so many times is the way that she just got back up and completely changed the trajectory of her life. She is speaking on stages across the globe, is such an incredible inspiration. This was truly such a deep, profound, meaningful conversation with her. And I don't even want to say a lot, because I want to really hand it over to her and hear how she completely changed her life. I mean, you are the queen of authenticity, Molly. It is such an honor to have you here. After just, you know, we had such a small interaction, I mean, so many years ago. Oh God, that trip really changed my life. The trip to Ibiza I'm referring to, I've talked about it a lot of times, but that was where I met you. Mm-hmm. And you had such a lasting impact on me with your confidence and just your ability to, like, you were just such a boss. Like, there was just something about you. And I remember Noah saying, and at that time we weren't even dating, we were all just friends, but he was like, Molly's the biggest boss here. He's like, she's the biggest G. Like, she bought her own first class ticket. I just remember that moment being like, oh, yeah, she exudes this energy. But your story is so riveting, as Aaron Sorkin, like, so perfectly said. And the way that you've reinvented yourself, I know, is going to continue to give so many people hope and knowing that they can turn it the hell around.
Thank you. And I think it's so funny because we had these parallel lives, but I just always remember how much you stood out in a crowd because it was dark.
You know, late.
It was dark and it was late, and you would just have this, like, glow about you. And it was funny, like, you were just one of those people that I really remembered. And what's funny about that Ibiza trip is, like, I remember that was towards the end where the walls were just so closing in on me. And by the end of that trip, I just remember sitting in a corner, everyone's having so much fun, and I'm sitting in a corner and I'm just like, I have to get out of this life. Mm. I have to. I have nothing left inside. And I was just so stressed, but we put it on. But you've just always had the best energy. And then just to see what you've done and where you came from. And it's like we started at the same place.
Yes.
But we both, I think, in order to be in that place, we're suppressing really important parts of ourselves. And maybe that's what I recognized.
I mean, you definitely did.
Yeah.
Because I most definitely was.
Same.
And it was actually that trip that I started to really love myself. And it sounds crazy, but I just left feeling like I know who I'm becoming, and I like who I'm becoming, and I want to continue to feel this embrace and, like, nourish it because I felt it just opening things up.
Interesting.
For me, I went to Ibiza. My boyfriend at the time had just broken up with me and said, have fun being a prop on that trip. And I was like, I really liked it. I was, like, so broken. I was telling Noah about I was, mm-hmm, like, devastated. And it shattered me in a sense. And then I left that feeling like, no one and nothing is going to define me but me. and being who I really am. And there was something about that trip that I started to see like my own light.
And something about someone saying, like you have the voices in your head that sometimes aren't so kind. But when someone says something like that to you, when someone has ever said something like that to me, it has the opposite effect on me. It doesn't knock me down. It's like, it brings out this fighter and this absolute determination to never let anyone sort of speak to me and let that be true. It's like you learn how to use it. And that's why sometimes I am like, just give me the bad stuff. Because that brings up the warrior. But not too much of it because I'm human. But those were the things that hurt me the most, drove me the most.
I mean, it shows. Like I sit back and I think we'll dive so deep into your story because it's mind-blowing, honestly. But you are the definition of a fighter. And I think that is why I was like, I wanted you here so badly because we've all been knocked down and continually knocked down. But like, you didn't just like get up. You busted the fucking doors down. And I'm like, how in the hell did you do that coming from such a low and not allowing that to define you? Like, how do you do that?
I mean, I think that it starts with a choice. So to understand somebody, I think you have to understand their history to a degree. And I grew up with this very charismatic father who loved talent and loved winning and loved success. And whether he meant to or not, that was the definition of how you felt loved and safe in my family. And my brothers were prodigies. Jeremy was number one in the world at 16 years old in Olympic skiing. He went on to win 3 world championships. He competed in 2 Olympics. One of them, he was a teenager. He went on to play in the NFL. He was an Abercrombie model. And if you're like wondering, thinking like this kid must be an asshole, no, he started this charity for senior citizens in our town at 21 because he felt like we didn't have the proper reverence for the elder generation. And so, you know, this is Jeremy, young prodigy. Jordan was just an absolute genius, went on to become a Harvard-educated cardiothoracic surgeon. And I tried. I had this like crazy back surgery in which they fused my top, basically my entire spine together, rendering it immovable. And everyone was like, okay, so you're done skiing. And I felt like in their minds, they're like, Jeremy's the skier anyway. But I got back on and I made the US ski team. And I, you know, I've just been a fighter. And then I have a different mind than my brother. It's hard for me to focus on things sometimes. And so in high school, I didn't really do that well. And I was like very shamed for it. And then in college, I figured it out. I was like, oh, okay. So my focus is shorter. So I'm going to total up the number of pages that I need to read on this syllabus for the entire semester, divided by days in the semester. And then I can take it in small bites and make little quizzes for myself. So like I got strategic about it and then I did really well in school, but like I wasn't going to Harvard. And so I just had this existential ache and this incredible drive to have a seat at that table. And, you know, I made the US ski team and I became nationally ranked and then I fell and retired and went back to the University of Colorado, where the next step was to go to law school. And I was just like, I don't know if I can do this right now. Like, my heart is broken. I don't know who I am. And I don't know if this works anymore because inputs aren't equaling outputs. And like, you know, and I was just like, maybe this life isn't for me. Maybe I just let my brothers have success. And, you know, I was just so lost. And so I came to LA and I started working for these crazy guys who, you know, and they had this poker game. And that first night, I didn't know what I was doing. I showed up in this like silly little dress with like a cheese plate. And I always talk about this, but my boss was like, you need to help me run this poker game. Don't mess up. So I was like Googling like, what kind of music do poker players like to listen to? What do they eat? And I made, you know, a playlist with The Gambler on it. I was young. I was from a small town. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. And it was mortifying because then all these famous people sort of walking in, and politicians and CEOs and billionaires. But as the night wore on, I was like, okay, if I can just get outside of myself right now and my embarrassment, what an opportunity here. Like, this is access at a very young age to inside information and capital and power. And I guess I was also primed for a rebellion because I had tried it the conventional way. I had given everything I had into the conventional way. Sometimes I was in so much pain after skiing, like I had to crawl around, but nobody recognized that because my brother was a prodigy. And I was just like, maybe this is something worth checking out. Cut to. But I think I wasn't going to stop until I reached some sort of pinnacle of what I considered or thought would be greatness. And then poker became the thing. And I started my own game, which was essentially kind of crazy because I didn't know what I was doing. And I was managing so much money and managing the things that would happen on those nights, which were crazy and dangerous. And what presented to me is that I was an entrepreneur. That was where I was really good. I was very good with people. Mm-hmm. When I meet someone, I authentically am so curious about them. And my brain just naturally wants to find the interesting or unique part of them. And then I became unafraid to talk about it. And so I was great with people. I started to be very good with strategy and problem solving and thinking on my feet. And all of a sudden, like, I had these games and I was making millions of dollars. And I was eventually running the biggest poker games in the world and acting as the bank for them, like settling the night. And these are games where people would lose up to $100 million in a night. And I learned so much. And in the beginning, it was so fun. You know, I like bought a Bentley with all cash and was, you know, would like have $1 million in cash in my apartment. And I brought all my friends along. I had them do odd jobs at the games. And I just felt it was like a dream. And then it started to get dark. And I think what happened was for most of the LA game, I really cared about the outcome. I never wanted to put someone in a seat who could lose everything for my own game. Like, my success was commingled with the success and the well-being of others. It was a kind of a do no harm philosophy. So I'm running these games. I'm making all this money. I am learning to be an entrepreneur. I'm learning about finance and the art world. And I'm able to have games with art dealers and artists if I want. Like, it's this Trojan horse that allows me to sort of infiltrate any part of society. And it was just like, I realized it was so much more than a poker game. If you did it right, it was a community and it was mythology and it was this secret, clandestine, exciting world. And, you know, I was very meticulous about the books and I was learning how to be a businesswoman. And then one of the really famous players who we've all seen in movies and who was really an ally to me for so long became more and more sort of pathologically obsessed with winning. And he was the biggest winner in the game. And he would call me and want me to invite certain people and not invite certain people to give him edge. And I started standing up to him and saying, now that this is my game, like, I have to run this with full objectivity and fairness. And so it was a slow evolution of he realized that I wasn't going to do his bidding. And then one day he pulled me aside and he said, you make too much money. And there were things that led up to that.
Mm-hmm.
Attempts at humiliation, you know, stuff like that. And by this time, I'd travel the world to recruit for this game. I had 20 people that worked for me. I was running all the books. I was managing the room and the employees, and I was financing a large part of the game. I had incorporated, like, it was my business, you know? It had gone from this little game in the basement of a rock and roll club to kind of an institution in Los Angeles. And he said, you make too much money. You're taking too much money off the table. That's money that should probably be going in my pocket. And he said, if you want to keep the game, you can work for me and I'll decide your salary. And I remember going home that night and knowing without question that he was more powerful than I was, that he had no problem being evil and playing dirty, and that I was at a deficit. But the question before me is, do you take this deal, keep this game, but lose your dignity, your sovereignty? And as much as I loved that game more than anything in my life at that point, sadly, more than a lot of the people in my life, because this had been a conduit to the hole inside of, like, what am I going to do that's significant, right? So it was so much more than a game. And ultimately, I said, no, you know, I'm not going to take that deal. And he called me the next week excitedly and said, don't bother calling the players. I took the game and you're done. And I was terrified because I didn't want to go back. See, that's the thing that I don't think I realized, right? Is that, and I think this is what happens to a lot of people when they get successful. They think, oh, well, somehow I got lucky. And if this is gone, then I have to go back to that life where I'm picking up dry cleaning for someone. No, you are here because you got yourself there. But I didn't realize that at the time. Plus, I really needed to prove to myself more than anything that somebody couldn't just do that to you. And so I was like, I'm going to build the biggest poker game in the world. I'm going to do it in New York City. I don't care that I don't know anyone in New York City. I don't care that it's 2008 and the economy has been brought to its knees and Wall Streeters are my sort of assets. Like, I'm going to do this. And so I came here and I met with a million poker players and I kept asking them, what's the problem with the current system? Because it was the same kind of scary game runners that were running the games for like 20 years. And they would tell me about being treated unfairly. And the way that I really ran my games and what I really focused on was treating people fairly, taking care of people, making them feel safe, making them feel seen and heard, not just the celebrities, everyone. Really just understanding what it means to have effective presence, which is, it's the science of how you make people feel. Really understanding that if you can, not in a manipulative way, but in an authentic way, really get someone's trust and make them believe that you care about them and that they are worthy, then they're going to want to do business with you. They're going to want to be friends with you. Like, it's much more simple than I think a lot of people realize.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
One of my biggest hobbies in life is testing skincare. I love being introduced to new brands that actually work and make such a difference in your skin. I've been using an amazing brand called Bareface for almost a year now and have noticed such a significance in my skin. I feel like every time I'm with Simon Huck, he's like, what did you do different? And I'm like, it's the toning pads from Barefaced. I've seen a massive, massive decrease in breakouts from this product alone. My skin definitely has more of a glow, and overall, it just feels smoother and healthier. Every one of their products is formulated to do the most. So with each and every product that you try, you really notice a difference.
Jordan Harper is amazing. She is the Bareface founder and CEO. She's a nurse practitioner, and she created the product line after treating thousands and thousands of patients and listening to their questions and concerns about skincare. Let me go back to those toning pads, because these babies are packed with antioxidants and calming ingredients and incredible acid blends. So when you use them, I use them at night after I cleanse my skin and I use a toner, then I go in again with the toning pads, because these really tackle clogged pores and uneven skin texture. So if you have breakouts or it's that time of the month, these are incredible to use, and I'm consistent with them. So whether it's that time of month or not, I use them every single night, because these products penetrate right deeply into the skin and you start to feel this little redness and this tingliness. And when you wake up, your face, I mean, it's noticeably clearer and the pigmentation is super dewy and really, really glowy. Head to their Instagram at Bareface to find a wealth of information on all things skincare. And you know, I always have a code for you. You can use MWH15 at checkout to get 15% off your first purchase on bareface.com. But I think people are so strategic.
They are, and they lose the authenticity, which means they lose the connection. And that is a big missed opportunity. Anyway, so I started talking to all these players and I found out that these games were sort of unfair and they weren't glamorous and they were letting pros play. And a lot of times people wouldn't get paid. And so I was like, okay, I'll be the bank. I will guarantee the games. And then I just started hiring socialites to recruit for me. Casino hoes, like anyone that was in New York City that knew people. And somehow by the end of that year, I had kind of taken over and then built the biggest private poker game in the country at the time. And this was the game that someone would eventually lose $100 million in, which is, you know, now sitting here with you is so crazy, so dysfunctional. But to me, in the warped world that I was in, it was a triumph and it made a lot of noise. And it showed me that it confirmed for me something I really needed to believe in. And that is that the unfair but more powerful person doesn't get to win all the time, doesn't get to dictate your life. And I'd been fighting that fight since I was a little kid in my family, you know, because my dad, and I love him. He's done more work than anyone I've ever seen, but he ran our family like a dictator.
Right.
And I was 100% of the time like activist freedom fighter. And so it was a tumultuous childhood. So then I start running the big games and the little games, and New York is crazy and I'm making more money and it's scary. And then, you know, I had the run-in with the mobster who literally came to my apartment and put a gun in my mouth and said, "You're going to give us a piece of your game or we're going to find your family in Colorado," telling me this while I have this like huge gun in my mouth and I'm so sure, you know, my teeth are chattering and I'm just so sure it's going to go off. And then he really like beat me up and then he took everything from my safe, including like, you know, I had a lot of cash, but like including photographs and things that my grandmother had left me. And I didn't know what to do. I couldn't call the cops. I couldn't call my parents. And I think that was the moment where I knew this thing had crossed over to a place that was very different than where I had started. But I slowly, I guess, you know, it happens in inches, where I had started to make this decision that was a little left of my heart, and then this decision, just small, you know, and then it becomes bigger and they compound. And then all of a sudden, like I remember looking in the mirror during that time, and you know, my face looked good. I didn't even know who I was. I didn't even know who I was. I couldn't have told you my favorite color. Like, I was a person that had become a chameleon for the love of money and power. And I lost myself. And then I got like this crazy thing that happened. I got the New York Times, and on the cover it said 125 arrested in the biggest mob-related takedown in New York City history. I never heard from them again. But then there was a couple other, you know, there was a guy running a Ponzi scheme and then some Russian guys running an insurance fraud scheme, and the feds were had thrown a confidential informant in. And then I started to do something that my attorneys told me not to do, to stay within the confines of not violating the federal statute, which was, they said, don't take a rake, don't take a percentage of each pot, let it be based on tips. And it was based on tips, but remember, I'm in charge of who gets these 9 coveted seats, and I'm also extending credit, so I'm loaning people. So when they won, they would tip me really well. So I was making millions of dollars every year. And I was getting sloppy, and I, like I said, I started to care less for people, and I started to let people play who maybe they had the money, maybe not, and started to realize that I was just really feeding into addiction and vice. And knowing that, I just kept doing it. And that really impacted my self-esteem and what I thought of myself. And, you know, then it becomes kind of easy to just self-destruct, to drink more, to take pills, and to start to take a rake, to cover your own butt. And the confidential informant saw that. I got a text message from one of my employees at one of my games, and they said, the FBI is here looking for you, don't come here. And I knew it was game over, and I just wanted to go home. Even though I was, my relationship with my parents was very fraught and there was a lot of distance between us, but I just wanted to be home with them. And I remember trying to buy a plane ticket to Denver and logging into my account and seeing that my account balance was -$9,999,099. And I made it home and the feds said, we've seized your assets because we believe you're making your money illegally. You don't need to come in right now. There's no investigation against you. But if you want your money back, you could come in and go on record and tell us about how you're making it, which is essentially a confession. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do that anymore. And so I moved in with my mom and my grandmother.
How old were you?
I was 33 and I was devastated. And it was all gone. Most of the friends, all of the money. And I was embarrassed. It was in the tabloids. Mm-hmm. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. And I had no idea. I didn't even have a bank account, let alone any money. Nobody wanted to take my phone call. And so I had to do some work, like the inner work, you know? Mm-hmm. The first thing I did is I went to rehab.
You did?
I did. I went to rehab. I think this was the first time I went to rehab, and I think I did it in a way to show my parents and the people around me that I was serious about changing, but I don't think I did it in a way to really like look at how I was using substances. But I was sober for a while. And in sobriety, I went through the 12 steps, and the 12 steps led me to 2 incredibly important things during that time. More than 2. Making amends is huge. All these things are huge. But the first was that I had to own this, that this was entirely my fault. Mm. I had near perfect information on the laws. I had all the opportunities in the world. I had found a way to make a lot of money. And people had been loyal to me, and I was the one that made that choice. And owning that and taking responsibility for that at first feels like swallowing a rock. And then it feels like so powerful, because you realize that if I own my whole life, all of it, everything that's ever happened to me, if I look at my part in it, even if I had nothing to do with the earlier traumas or whatever, you're a kid, whatever, but my part in that was you're still holding on to it. You're still letting it identify you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you can learn to let those things go, because you have too much damn pride to let those people or those things have that power over you anymore, you know? Like, I had to get angry sometimes.
Yeah.
I had to go into the shadows and look at the things that I did, the parts of myself that I didn't want to look at. And I did it with an amazing woman who is like this Puerto Rican woman from the Bronx. And she's like half Tony Montana, half Mother Teresa. And she's this perfect combination of not going to let you off the truth, but going to love you so hard through it.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. That's when I started meditating, which changed my life in a huge way. And in this weird way, I started to be really happy. And then I've got this little job, and this was 2 years since I'd run a game. I got this little job in LA at this production company, and I moved into this little apartment, and it felt like a fresh start. It really did. And then 5 days later, in the middle of the night, I got arrested by 17 FBI agents with machine guns and high beam flashlights. And they put me in handcuffs. And they put this piece of paper in front of me that said the United States of America versus Molly Bloom. Then they took me to jail. And I remember sitting in the jail cell. I was like, how long am I going to be here? No one gives you any answers, you know? And then seeing some of the people I know like paraded past me in the other cells. And I'm just like, I haven't run a game in 2 years. Like, what is this, you know? And I had a day and a half to get to New York City to find an attorney who's going to represent me in this very serious indictment. The press release said I was looking at like 60 years. And I don't have a dollar. And my mom had just put her house up to bail me out, and my father and I aren't speaking. And so I had 8 meetings that day. 7 out of the 8 attorneys were like, it's going to be $250,000 to even look at this. And I said, I don't have any money, but I promise you, you can ask around about me. Like, I will find a way to pay you. And they were like, no. And then I met Jim Walden, and he was at Gibson Dunn, which is this very prestigious defense firm. And Jim had been a former federal prosecutor who had gone after the 5 crime families. He believes heartily in justice. He's so noble. And he looked at the indictment and he said, I would have never brought this indictment unless there's something I don't know here. This is for Flash. And he said, I'm going to help you.
Wow.
And I started working with Jim, and I walked into his office after the arraignment, which was terrifying. It was me and 33 male criminals, some of them not serious, but a lot of them extremely serious Russian mobsters who I'd never met in my whole life. And they didn't know me, and they didn't know what I knew or what I didn't know, right? You know? And I remember working with Jim, and the first thing I said to him was, okay, what's our strategy and what's our angle going to be? And he said, integrity. And I just remember standing in his office, and I was like, it just hit me in the gut, because that is who I wanted to be. I wanted to be like a civil rights lawyer or an international like human rights lawyer. And you know, I wanted to be Jim Walden. And here I was under federal indictment publicly. And I just remember saying to myself in that room on that day, no matter what, I will never abandon myself again. No matter what is on the other side of it, I will never not do something that doesn't feel in alignment with my heart and who I am and who my parents raised me to be. And it was funny because the next day we got a call from one of the prosecutors in the Southern District, and they wanted a meeting. And we walked in there and they were very excited to meet me, especially the lead prosecutor. And he said, you know, we're really excited to meet you. And ultimately what they wanted was they wanted me to become a confidential informant. And they didn't care about the guy that beat me up, the crime families. They didn't care about the guy that was running the Ponzi scheme or the guys that were running the insurance fraud scheme. They didn't care about that. They wanted inside information on the politicians, the celebrities, and the billionaires. And if I was willing to do that, they would give me all my money back and they would give me a deferred prosecution, which was going to keep me out of prison. And I had 48 hours to make that decision. And I got to the same place. This was my fault. I made these choices. These people that they want me to drag their life through the mud. And when you sit on the other side of the United States government and you understand their unchecked, unlimited power and resources, it's crazy. And here I was, like, I ran a poker game, right?
I mean, it makes you feel so powerless,
yeah,
right? And
right.
You're like, this is what I did.
Yeah, right. I mean, I paid my taxes the whole time.
Right.
Anyway, so I got to this place where I said, if I have to go to jail, I'll go to jail. If I have to lose all my money, I'll make more money. But I have to do what feels right in my heart, and that is to stand for the consequences of my actions and not drag other people, a lot of them who I knew their children, through this process. So that's what I did. And then it was a year to be sentenced. I had to wait a year to be sentenced. And my dad and I weren't speaking. And I remember he called me a couple of weeks before sentencing because we all thought I was going to prison. And he said, you are my only daughter and my firstborn. And you're probably going to go to prison. And we're going to work this out. And so he came. In the movie, Jessica's having a mental breakdown on the roller skating rink. And in real life, it was just he and I for about 2 days talking. And I finally got up the courage to ask him the question that had haunted me my whole life. Because I have these really high achieving brothers. And they saw what I got from fighting as hard as I fought. And that was punishment after punishment. So they got smart, you know? They were like, they just did what they were told. And I believed that my dad loved them more than he loved me because they were boys and because they were better at things. If you want to strip it down to its most raw form, that's what I believed.
Right.
And that's what I carried around. And that's so much of what drove me to do the things that I did, like ambitious and otherwise. And so, but I was always so afraid to ask him the question because my fear was he would lie to me and say that he didn't, but I would see it in his eyes, or he would tell me the truth that he did. But I got really real with him and I said, why do you love my brothers more than you love me? I don't think that's what parents are supposed to do. And he was like, listen, there have been times where I've liked them more, which was valid. But I love you every bit as much as I love them. And he said, I don't know if I did it right, but I believe that the world is a hard place and I think it's harder for women. And I wanted to make you tough. And he said, I think I took it too far and I think I did it in the wrong way. But I want you to know that that was my intention. And it was this very emotional moment and we were both crying. And from that moment, we were able to build on a real foundation. And I think that was the first time I was like really vulnerable and saw what comes from being really vulnerable. Mm. Now it could have gone the other way.
Yeah.
But at least I would have had my answer. But now I have my dad. And
I need tissues.
Oh my God.
That's so beautiful.
I love you.
I'm sorry. I had no idea that I was going to cry.
Oh.
And that's just the most beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is. And those are some of the hardest questions to ask, you know, but it's better to know. And it just might be one of the biggest gifts of your life, you know?
You crack each other open.
Right.
Right? It's right. Like you, I'm sure, helped you see him in a light that he had never allowed himself to be seen, to break down the walls.
Right.
And that's when you let people in.
Yeah. And that's when you start to also stop deciding people are either good or bad. And you understand that humans are designed with a lot of flaws. And to start to just normalize that, you know? And not write people off because they did this one thing. But like,
yeah.
And most of the time I've found when people are exhibiting atrocious behavior, it's because they have unmet needs or because they have pain. And there's been times where I've kind of gotten down in the mud, as my friend Simon says, with them and had those conversations and gotten to understand why they act that way. And anyway, so I go to sentencing. My whole family's there, and I get a judge who is young, 41 years old, Obama appointed, super disappointed with my life choices.
Yeah.
But he said, I'm very moved by the people that have shown up for you today. I'm very moved by the character letters. I'm moved by your prior life. I mean, I had letters from coaches and professors, and he said, and I'm moved by Jim Walden's representation of you. And I see that you went to rehab and you did community service. And so he said, I'm not going to put you in jail. Which was, man, I lost my knees, you know?
Yes.
I mean.
I need a sip.
Yeah. I need a drink.
Did you feel that you were going?
I did.
You thought you were going?
Yep. Yeah. And I had that conversation with Jim and I was like, whatever, like I'll just learn a new language and mentor some women. He's like, Molly, women's federal prison is not like men's federal prison. The guards are men. They rape the inmates. Like, the women are not generally like white collar criminals. It's a dangerous place. Do not be blasé about this. But I tried to like be very strong and very, but when he said that, man, I, you know, I lost my knees. Like,
I'm sure your parents did.
Yeah.
Your family.
Yeah. And I remember sitting at, being so happy, right? But then sitting at dinner that night with my family, and Jordan had just graduated Harvard for like the 90th time. And Jeremy had just been like inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. And I'm like, there I am, the family felon. Damn it. You know?
But you didn't like, go to prison.
Yeah. But I didn't go to prison, but I'm still like 35 years old, millions of dollars in debt, a convicted felon and a social pariah.
You owed all that money.
I owed millions of dollars and they were going to come for it. And I was living with my mom and I remember going home and walking the mountains, meditating and just saying like, there's a solution here. I don't know what it is, but there's a solution here. And then I just started thinking about the story. And I said, this is a unique story and our stories are so important and I'll write a book. So I wrote a book proposal and I took it to all the publishers and I got all these like exciting meetings with all these like top editors and they all wanted this celebrity takedown piece. And I said, if people have talked about being in these games, I will mention their names. That's why I mentioned some and don't mention others. I will not tell a story that ruins anyone's lives. And I don't think the real story is celebrity gossip. And so I got turned down. Over and over and over. And finally, I got a small book deal, but it was a book deal. And I thought, like, I'm going to write my book and it's going to change my life, you know? And so I published the book and I think like 20 people bought it. Probably most of them were related to me. And I was like, okay, well, still my only idea is the story. And so I just got really clear and really strategic. And I was like, I made this short list of the most prolific filmmakers in Hollywood. Shonda Rhimes, Kathryn Bigelow, Sorkin, Spielberg. And I looked at the list and I I said, I think Sorkin's the one. And at the time, he was the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood. He might still be. And he wrote A Few Good Men in The Social Network. And I just felt like he would see the version of this story that other people wouldn't. And I also felt like he was brave, and he needed to be, because there were so many powerful people that were trying to shut this down. Mm-hmm. And I kept trying to get a meeting with Aaron, and people would like laugh me out of their office. Aaron's not going to write the movie about the poker princess, you know? But there's something so powerful about losing everything and becoming fearless. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, ego is checked at the door. You're just fearless. And it's important to remember that sort of like vibe and that energy when you do put it back together, because it's so powerful. And you don't want to go back to that place where your ego is fragile and you have fears and whatever, or you let your fears
take over.
Right. And I got that meeting with Aaron, Ken Hertz, who's another person that just sort of descended into my life in like guardian angel style. He was an entertainment attorney in LA, and he has a lot of connections. And he's like, I'll send Aaron the book. And I remember going to meet with Aaron, and I had this moment like right before I walked in, what am I doing? He writes like movies about Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs. Like, what am I doing? And then I remembered a couple things. I remember watching so many people play poker, which is in so many ways such a great metaphor for life. And so many people, when they would get a bad beat, they would go back into this little shell and they would be unwilling to take risks again. They would be unwilling to get bold and take risks again, even when there was opportunities on the table. And I kept books on everyone. And over time, those people lost big. And I think over time in life, that's how you lose too, right? And then I also thought, no, I have taken responsibility for all of this. I've protected people. I have not taken any of the easy way outs. And I'm going to have this meeting. And I went in and told
him. Did you meditate?
Oh, yeah. Like the whole plane ride, like breath work, meditate. Yes. Like I was probably like too zen, you know? But I remember, I always talk about this in every speech because I just think it's so funny. And Aaron is just such a funny person. But I remember telling him my story, and he was just like stone face, like giving me nothing, poker face. And when I was done, he was like, well, I'll tell you one thing, kid. I've never met someone so down on their luck and so full of themselves.
The confidence.
Yeah.
You just have that thing.
Or I can just fake
it. Or you can just you know? Bring it.
Yeah, because like that's how you become confident to some degree, is you act it.
And you own.
Yeah.
You own.
Yeah.
All of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which makes you embody something different. I am not typically a cleanse kind of girl, but Chroma's 5-day reset is unlike any detox or cleanse on the market. In many ways, it's truly the anti-cleanse, which I am all about. Each day consists of 10 nutrient-rich, deliciously, like really good, satiating meals and beverages. They are also easy to prepare, so I like to keep the super porridge in my bag. It's probably my favorite thing in the 5-day reset. Even if I'm not doing the reset, I keep the super porridge in the office or in my bag, because all you have to do is add water or a non-dairy milk, and it doesn't get easier than that. So if you're hungry and on the fly like I am, it's just an easy no-brainer to get something in to fuel you so you can keep going throughout the day. I keep their cookie butter on hand, especially after having Dr. Ellen Bora on and just really emphasizing this crash that we can all experience throughout the day. And it's just your blood sugar is crashing. And for me, that's when I experience spikes in anxiety. So now, I mean, we did a video of this. I just take a scoop of that cookie butter, and did I already say the super porridge is my favorite? Because this is definitely neck and neck, because it's so good. Like, to not eat the entire jar it takes some work, but it's very filling. So all you really need is that big spoonful, and it keeps that blood sugar at bay and makes you feel really calm and really good. And if you don't want to do the 5-day reset or you're not continuing a 5-day reset, you can also purchase all of their products individually. So you can incorporate your favorite foods like me. I love that super porridge in my bag. And now for the discount code, you can go to chromawellness.com and use code MWH15 to get 15% off all products.
One of the most powerful I've ever felt in my whole life was that day with those prosecutors, with all their power behind them and all their resources and all their leverage, and be able to look at them and say, you know what? I don't think so. I lost a lot of money that day. I potentially could have lost my freedom. But that's what they talk about when they say, you can't control all the time what happens to you, but you can control your reaction. Mm-hmm. And in being able to do that, nobody can take your power.
No one.
No one can take your sovereignty, you know?
I do.
And so Aaron wrote the movie. He made his directorial debut, did really well. It gave me a second chance. And then I met Devin, who is the father of my child. We got married, which is not something I thought I would do.
Oh, I remember. I cried. I was like, I'm so happy to see you with your person and not even being that close, but just like, I just felt such a way for you.
Yeah. Well, he is my person in a certain way. Mm-hmm. I had frozen my eggs at 36. And the place I did it was like, you're good. You should be fine, which is what a lot of fertility clinics tell people. Not so much anymore, because now they have to be responsible for right. the results. But it was I think it's a technology that's been massively oversold. And I didn't even think for one second that we would have an issue. At 41, we fertilized the frozen eggs and none of them worked. Mm. So I was 41 and the doctors tested my fertility markers, the AMH and the follicle count. And I had a doctor at the time give me about a 3% chance. And so I did 9 rounds of IVF.
I remember.
Yeah. And then I got pregnant, which was amazing. But during, I'd say the last 6 months, I had started to question whether Devin was the one.
Yeah.
And 2 months pregnant, it was really clear to me that he wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I knew that just waiting wasn't the right thing to do. We needed to figure this out now so that Fiona would have this structure that existed for her. And we would do all of our fighting and negotiating and everything. And it turned out to be this beautiful conversation between he and I, where it was like, we love each other so much, but it's not like that.
Yeah.
And we both cried and like grieved and like hung out for 48 hours. And I moved back to Colorado and he was finishing his PhD. So I was kind of like pregnant and going through a separation and really terrified that the pregnancy wasn't going to work because of all the stuff. And
I prayed so hard. I really did.
It worked.
I knew you were going to have a baby.
You and Allie both said that.
I knew it.
I know. I love that you knew that.
I did.
And she was born and I just saw Devin become a different person. Like he just broke open and he was finishing his PhD in North Carolina. So for the first year and a half of Fiona's life, I was not only responsible for her financial care, but for her care. And we made sure that Devin flew out every month because I want him to have this relationship with her. But it was really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And it is really, really hard. And I have gotten to this place. I started working again when she was 3 weeks old and leaving this child who I still didn't believe was going to survive, you know, because you have so much heartbreak in IVF, and having to leave her and get on a plane so that I could support her. And then I was dead set on breastfeeding her for a year. So I'd be like pumping. I'd like go to Australia for a day, like drop off milk. Like, I mean, it was just, it was a nutty, nutty first year and a half. And I now am like trying to figure out how to work and not miss out on this.
Yeah.
And I'm also so tired. I've never cried on a podcast.
I can't say the same.
I cried.
No, I know. I know in my way.
I know.
You know, it's so hard.
It's so
hard. And you can't do it all. I think that's one of the biggest self-discoveries of really powerful powerhouse women and people. It's like we think we can take on every damn thing and we can do it until we can't.
Yeah.
You know, and that's good to know that.
I can get my mind there because of how much we meditate and yeah. how much we love. But my body is just, it's not cooperating, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to miss her life. And I don't want her to have to, at 2 years old, just be on these like 7 hour, 8 hour travel days,
right.
you know? So this is what I know when they call it in the program, the gift of desperation.
Mm.
And it happens in different ways, but it's very clear to me that something needs to change. And it's always been very clear to me that my life won't feel complete if I don't do something at scale mm-hmm. to empower young women and women.
Yeah.
And so it's forcing me into this place that I really want to be, which is to start building a program, communities, mentorship, and eventually leadership academies
mm.
for young girls.
Ooh. Yes.
Because not in a down with the patriarchy way at all, but we should have more women in high leadership positions because we live in this world too. I don't think it needs to be all women.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it, you know what I mean? But like, I believe that from the smallest sort of iteration of it, I believe that in similar ways that you do, that I've been on both sides of having power and agency, and that the other side is a life that is so much more extraordinary. So I really want to teach power, and I don't care if that power that someone learns is because they want to be the best mom and like find the best partner
mm-hmm.
or if they want to be president of the United States.
Mm.
Like it all comes from the same place. I'm just tired of seeing women not be able to live the life that they're meant to live because of lack of tools
mm-hmm.
or lack of community or lack of mentorship.
You're right.
And so I'm launching a podcast and then also eventually a mentorship program.
Molly's masterclass came to my mind. That's I dropped right in.
I love that. I want to call it a smart girl's guide to everything because
Ooh.
It's like applying high level strategy to this plight of being a girl or a woman in today's world and the ways that like you can empower yourself. And I think I pull so much from how AA is structured. It's sort of like this education, and then it's a community, and then it's mentorship. And then after you get mentored, you turn around and you mentor someone. And I just think that the women's movement and women in general can become so divisive and competitive.
Ugh. The most.
But when you find a community of women who believe in you or who, you know, mentor, it's life-changing.
Life-changing.
So I think the universe is just moving me to that place. But first, I need to get well again,
right.
if that makes sense.
It does.
I think this idea that we do a little work and we fix ourselves and then everything's fine forever and ever and ever. I'm in another place where I need to do more work and figure more things out and take a look at the decisions that I'm making. What am I choosing? Can I scale down the way that I'm living and work less and be there for my daughter?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's those truths that I have to look at. Why haven't I started it yet? Am I scared?
Yeah.
That it's not going to compare to Molly's game? Hell yeah. But it's like, then you go back and you tap into that F it, right? Like, it really is you and whatever your spiritual sort of connection is. And if it fails, that's fine. I love a good comeback. You know?
And that you've had a few. If there is anyone here to just say to you and to empower you to like, look at what you've done. Look how many times you have continued to step into this truth of who you are and to look yourself dead in the mirror and to be so honest with yourself and with mistakes that you've made and to be able to continue moving forward. There was a part of me that when you were like, well, you as my person, and I like was like, oh, I kicked myself. And I'm like, no, this is all a part of it. Like,
yeah,
you can find your person. You can understand that's not your person.
Yeah.
It helped you birth your person.
Yeah.
And it's, you have the ability for us all to recognize this incredible strength inside of ourselves mm-hmm. that we all need. Mm-hmm. To see, and it's really hard to see when you're dealing with life and all the things that we're up against, but you have continued to pave the way from listening, from no longer reacting, but responding mm-hmm. and really letting it land mm-hmm. and to see what it is and to no longer continue what you don't want. So take this. I hope, like, you never cried on a podcast before.
Never.
I hope you take this moment to know that, like, this is the moment of change.
Yeah.
And you get to change it.
Yeah.
You know that. No one can do this but you and the support of who's guiding the way.
And it feels very right that it's on your podcast because I can't tell you how many times I have tuned in. Even if I couldn't finish the workout, even if I couldn't like finish the meditation, just to hear the strength and the reminder and the love and the truth of your message. I mean, you were like one of my good friends during pregnancy.
When you would post me, I'd be like, I can't, but I remember, I'm like, I can't believe like you do my workouts because I'm just, I admire you so much.
Well, Melissa, I admire you so much and what you are doing in the world. Like, I feel like you were kind of like one of the first women who is in that sort of space of like fitness and everything to totally stress making sure the mind's healthy and meditation. And I'm sure sometimes that was hard because meditation's like not that popular.
People skip over it.
Right. But you're so consistent with it. And I think that you've changed a lot of people's lives. You've certainly changed mine because your message is simple, it's pure, and it's profound. And like when you speak on your videos or whatever, you really feel the love and the intention, deep calling you have to want people to get well, to want people to get powerful. And like, you have been a big part of my journey, big. And so to sort of have this moment here feels really powerful and it feels really right.
Thank you.
from club rats to profits.
Listen, you can literally do anything that you truly and intentionally put your mind to. And I think the biggest word that stands out for me is maintaining a sense of integrity through it all, because people have lost it.
Yeah. Yep.
I have dissolved relationships in my life. And I think you said something so beautifully that we all fuck up, right? But when someone repeatedly does and they have not adapted the tools or to at least see the shit that they do, I am sorry. Go do your work. I'm here. I actually, no disrespect, wish you the best, but like, you got to go do that on your own.
Yeah.
And then come back around when you...
Because the question is, do they wish you the best?
No.
Right.
They don't.
So to keep someone like that in your life is codependent. It's healthy. It's people-pleasing. It's all the stuff. And we don't have time for that.
None.
Kids,
zero.
Jobs.
Please save it. Stop. Yeah. Everyone.
Yeah.
With the bullshit.
Yeah.
So over it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, can we just be real? And if you can't, take a course. Take Molly's, I don't know, like something. But
yeah, they're on a journey.
They're on a journey and we all are.
And I like, I always see the good in people. I always want to see the good in people. Like, even some of the people that would like cheat in my poker game, I'm like, but tell me about your childhood.
I'm the same.
But at some point, it's like, it's their own journey. You can't save them. I have this conversation with Allie all the time, my best friend Allie.
Love her.
Because she is like, she wants to save everyone all the time. And then there are people that she has invested so much time and so much love into that screw her over.
And it's not reciprocated.
No, because they're just there for the more.
Of course. Yeah. So once you identify that, I think this is, we could literally have a whole other podcast on that. Pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be cold or mean or like this mean girl shit.
Love.
Like, enough of that. It's with love and letting go.
And like, please, I hope you figure it out. Truly.
Please, God, we all do it. Do it for you. For the people around you.
Yeah.
Okay, I have one last thing to ask you.
Okay.
This was just, I'm just so taken by you, first of all. And I think this is the least I've spoken, and I'm so happy and proud of myself because I had, all I wanted to do was listen to you, and everything you said needs to be heard. So thank you for opening your heart. And I would love to just end with what it means to you that you do this so beautifully, but what does it mean to you to move with your heart?
First of all, I love that that's the title. I was like, when you were talking about your podcast, I'm like, what is she gonna name it? It's gonna be so good. So for many, many years, to avoid being hurt, I armored up and I moved with my mind strategically, at times manipulatively, and it was to try to keep myself safe. Right? And you can't really keep yourself safe. And all you're doing when you're doing that is denying yourself of the full human, beautiful experience. And so I think to move with heart is to get truly brave and to say to life, say to people, you can break my heart as many times as you want, and I'm going to remain open. And I'm going to remain alive, courageously alive. And that's how I'm going to stay resilient and stay a part of this beautiful existence, because it is beautiful.
So beautiful. And so moving and touching and inspiring and motivating and empowering and just... Aaron Sorkin is a smart, smart man.
He's the best. I still talk to him every day.
I mean, what a journey. Where can everyone find you? Are you writing another book?
Like, I am writing another book.
Oh, I felt it. Did you say it? You didn't. No.
It's on effective presence.
Ooh.
Because we're forgetting how to connect. Effective presence with an A. And it's literally the science of how you make people feel. We all leave an emotional footprint on the world. And it's shocking how many people don't even consider how they are making people feel when they walk into a room.
Fucking mind-boggling. Yeah. I can't even. Some of the most powerful.
Yeah.
The ones who are lifted so high on a pedestal. Yeah. Guess what? I knocked that fucking pedestal over.
Yeah.
No more.
No
more. We're all here.
Yeah.
Same playing field.
Yeah, let me, show me about your character.
Yeah.
Show me about your
kindness. I don't
kindness.
Care what no. you've mm-hmm. done, guru.
Yeah,
but,
right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No.
I want to know, like, how you treat the people in your life. But then there's the people that aren't malicious. They just are an autopilot.
Clueless.
Yeah. They're just an autopilot. And it's a gigantic missed opportunity. So Effective Presence is the book. And then the much bigger endeavor is what I've started to put together with the podcast and the mentorship app and community and whatever that becomes.
Mm. Beautiful. Because you never know.
You never know.
And just.
And you just got to do it.
You just got to do it. And you got to go on the ride because look it.
I know. So I'm on Instagram. I'm Molly Bloom. I'm incredibly inactive, but I'm about to get more active.
Yes, I love when you amp up the activity.
Because I have to.
I love watching and especially when you're on stage. And I mean, not to mention, this was something too. Fortune 100 named you one of the most powerful women. Like, how does that land?
I don't know. You spoke at Harvard.
Isn't it? I mean,
it's crazy.
I struggled in school too. So I was like, hey, are you sure? Like, no. You're the right Melissa.
Yeah. I just got invited to speak at the Oxford Debate Society, which is like 200 years old. And like, I got the invitation and I'm like, are you sure?
I'm like, yes, what? They're sure.
But yeah, but what a great opportunity to stay true to our message and mm-hmm. not conform. And yeah, it's all magical. It's also hard. I'm telling you right now, like, I kind of want to start making videos. You know how it's like, get ready with me, like get well with me, you know, and like what that looks like.
Wait, that's huge.
Yeah, because I have to do some work. I have to like get well again.
I want to bring you back when you
just I'll come
work
back whenever.
Through this. But just I'd love to support and just any way be a never-ending guide in your life as you have been for me without even knowing it.
Yeah. So same. Always.
I can't wait to see what you do next. Keep going for all of us.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Oh my God.
Oh,
no one has
my
a bigger heart
God.
Than you. You're the best person I know.
I love you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. We have a special offer for our Move with Heart listeners. When you join MWH as a new member, you will receive an entire month, that's 30 days for free. And this is in addition to our 7-day free trial. All you have to do is head to melissawoodhelp.com and use code MOVEWITHHEART. At MWH, we believe this practice is not just about building this body you desire. This work is about building a better, stronger relationship with yourself. And that is why we offer everything from movement, meditation, and nutrition to help you not only look, but most importantly, feel your best. Follow me on Instagram at Melissa Wood Tepperberg and MWH at Melissa Wood Health. Tune in for an all new episode next week, and I cannot wait to see you all on the mat.